Peter got his PhD in physics from UC Berkeley. He then went on to do actually quite a bit of physics. Had a number of publications in physics, and then had the great wisdom to move into neuroscience. He's at UCLA for a number of years in the Department of Neurobiology. And then he went to the Gatsby Computational Unit at University College London, where he has made his way through the ranks and is currently a professor. Peter is a very well-known scientist internationally, and he's done a great deal to help us understand how computations are actually performed in neural circuits, realistic neural circuits. He's going to tell us more about this.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. So it's been a real pleasure here. I mean, everybody else says that, right? It's been a real pleasure. It's actually been a real pleasure. So I had a great time talking. to people yesterday. I actually learned things. It's been a lot of fun, and I also appreciate the weather. It's just like London. Okay. So I'm going to start with the pre-introduction intro. So first of all, ask questions. So I practiced this talk this morning. It's only 40 minutes. So there's plenty of time for questions. Also, if you don't ask questions, I'll talk faster and faster and faster. And that's really bad. Okay, I'm going to start with a pre-introduction introduction, give you a little feel for my work and also how this talk fits into what I do. So this is kind of an obvious statement. What the brain does is compute stuff. If you hang on the lab, it computes things like this, right? It's that line to the left or right of vertical. But ultimately, I'm interested in the much harder computations it does. So, for instance, you can go to a movie and relay a plot summary to your friend, right? You do that really, really easily. So it's very hard for computers. A lot of us can do things like this, right? Maybe not as well as this person, but, we all have pretty good motor control. We can extract, in a very cluttered environment, we can almost always figure out what we're supposed to do, right? And this is true, no matter what the chair is, it's upside down, it's on top of the ball, or maybe realize this is way too good to be true, and walk away. So you can be really, really good at these hard problems. We can even some of us can solve problems like this, right? In the math department, I had no idea if this is actually true, but it was hard. But anyway, if people can solve this, they can understand it. So people can do really, really, really hard problems, and the long-term goal of my research is to understand how the brain performs these really hard computations. Now, I'm not alone here, right? And it turns out this isn't that hard, right? A couple steps. Figure out what algorithm the brain uses for a specific computation, okay? Understand how to implement a network of neurons, and then repeat for the next computation. And this really is what I've been doing for most of my career. It's the approach I've been taking. It sort of involves lots of things, neurocoding, network dynamics, but this is really what I've been after. So it's straightforward in principle. It's got a couple problems. And the first and probably biggest is the figure out what algorithm the brain uses step is hard. And when I said hard, it means in almost all interesting cases, unsolved. Okay? However, people are making progress. And I think eventually we're going to understand how at least we might see or hear. Right? We will eventually have algorithms for vision, probably. Probably in the order of decades. Okay? But the other problem is it's not clear whether any general principles will emerge. Okay? So the vision, audition, motor control probably use very, very different algorithms, right? So you can understand vision. So for instance, if you actually had an algorithm that did vision, right, and there are some computer vision algorithms that work okay, if you took that and gave it auditory data, it wouldn't work at all, right? Try to make it do motor control, it wouldn't work at all. So I'm sure, you understand anything deeply enough. You'll understand something, but maybe sort of this sort of depressing thing, we have to step through one computation after another. So my current view actually shifts a little bit, but this has been steady for a while. If there are general principles in the brain that are related to learning. So your brain is an amazing learning machine, right? You learn very fast, and you learn very well, right? In a very, very cluttered environment, you're massively versatile. Right? You sort of know what to learn when, and you're good at it, okay? That's what I'm going to talk about today. So that's sort of... I emphasize, algorithms and computation are still extremely important. Okay? Eventually, we have to know what they are if we really understand how the brain works. The hope is that if we understand learning at a relatively deep level, we'll get insight into actually computations. This neuroscience, the hope is, plays a big role. But again, if you understand anything very, very deeply, it's bound to interact. So for instance, learning and inference, it's well known they interact. Okay? So you understand learning better, you can understand inference better. Okay, so we switch to learning. Another obvious statement, learning is hard. But it's not hard in the way you think it is. In some sense, it's bizarre we can learn anything, right? And the problem is, we have lots of synaptic strength to adjust, on the order of 10 to the 14th, okay? We get relatively noisy and unreliable information about which ones to change and by how much. Here are a couple of examples. You reach into a hot oven and burn your hand. Which of your 10 to the 14th synapses do you adjust, right? Even if you reach by a factor of a billion, you have 100,000. And many of you have built, I'm sure, models that had parameters. And so once you get past about 2, once you get up to 5 or 10, you tear your hair out, right? It's a complete nightmare. Imagine if you had 10 to the 14th, okay? And this is what the brain is faced with. And there are much harder problems, right? You come home from work and find that your significant other has run off with your best friend. Okay? Which of your synapses do you adjust? And now this is a really noisy feedback signal. Either you have bad taste in significant others, bad taste in best friends, maybe you have a bad personality. You just don't know what to do, right? And yet we're faced with these problems all the time and we have to do something. So the point is, given sensory input, the brain doesn't really know which synapses to change or by how much. Okay? And to make things worse, the world changes, right? So the optimal synapses and circuits change. The optimal synapses today are going to be different from the optimal ones tomorrow. So it looks kind of hopeless. It's shocking, like I say, the brain actually learns anything. But we actually know how to handle these problems, right? Whenever we find ourselves in a low information, high noise situation, we know uncertainty is important. Our hypothesis is uncertainty is important to synapses too, at the synaptic level. And really, the idea is that the brain computes probably diffusion number synaptic strengths, not just synaptic strengths, and uses those for all sorts of things, okay? And that's really going to be the focus of the talk today. That's sort of the new proposal. It doesn't keep track of the value of the weight, its value, and the uncertainty. So this has two immediate implications, at least two implications. The first is that keeping track of uncertainty weights can improve learning, okay? And the reason's kind of obvious if you think about it for 20 years. It took us this long to get into this. If you know the value of a synapse really, really well, right, you get some kind of feedback signal. The feedback signal is almost always noisy, right? Nobody goes and tells the brain this synapse should be half a millivolt. So if you already know what synapse is really, really well, why bother to change it, right? So the amount of plasticity should depend on uncertainty, okay? And that's going to be the bulk of my talk. Using Bayesian analysis will derive optimal learning rules that show they perform better than your standard classical rules. So this makes two very strong testable predictions. It may also provide a new way of thinking about plasticity, okay? And I'm going to get to that at the end of the talk. And that's actually what I'm most excited about. So the other thing is keeping track of uncertainty in weights can improve performance, okay? And this is more speculative and a little more subtle. Uncertainty in weights translates into uncertainty in the outside world. And we all know that uncertainty is critical for accurate decision making. Okay? So let's take a classic Q integration task. You see an object that makes a noise. We all know how to solve this. We've seen this millions of times, right? By now, your visual vision produces some distribution about where it is. Addition usually is broader. You combine these optimally, you get combined kind of distribution, and that's where it is. So this has been in literature for over a decade now. We're all very used to it. But where do the error bars come from? Okay? They're not given to us by God. The brain's got to construct them. And so you sit there in a lab, you hear the beep, you see the object, and now, basically, somewhere in the visual cortex, you construct this distribution. So in the auditory cortex, you construct the distribution. And your ability to compute these distributions depends on the networks in your brain. It's a mechanism thing, right? You know, sound or phonons come in, and you have to figure out where these distributions are. Okay? You have to adjust your weights to do this. And this is a simple enough problem, you're kind of born doing it okay, but you actually get better and better. Okay? And if you get things wrong, you'll make mistakes. So for instance, suppose that, you know, this is optimal Q combination. In this case, suppose that the two distributions were like that, right? Audition, you should have had small error bars because it's a dark room and you can hear pretty well. And vision, you didn't do so well. You should be over here, right? So because you got your error bars wrong, you got the wrong answer. Not only the wrong sort of error bars in your answer, but actually the wrong answer, which could be very bad in situations. And it could be, certainly. And so these error bars are influenced by how accurate you think your weights have been set. Right? So if you know how accurately your weights have been set, you can do a much better job estimating errors. So to summarize, keeping track of the uncertainty in weights can do three things: improve learning, improve performance, and give us new insight into learning. The bulk of my talk will be on the first one, improving learning. And that's because this is sort of a hard topic, and we've made the most progress on this. In some ways, it's in some ways it's the least interesting. I think it is kind of interesting, but you know, improving learning, we get sort of factors of 2 to 5 to 10, depending. But it's kind of nice, sorry. Say a little bit about improving performance, very little actually. And then I spend a little at the end of the talk, give us new insight into plasticity in general. Okay, so that's the story. So I'll start with a pretty standard setup. If you're a neuroscientist, you hang around neurons. We have a neuron that's getting input. So each of these little blips is actually, think of this as a filtered memory potential of the soma. So these are caused by spikes. They're presynaptic neurons, N is big-ish. Nobody really knows how big, but probably in the order of thousands. And a connection strength is actually what you get in a paired recording, right? So it takes into account the fact you have multiple contacts. So this is the standard scenario, right? Neuron gets input, it gets memory potential. Sub-threshold memory potential looks like this. It's noisy. We'll ignore spikes. And the first approximation, this is not a bad estimate of what the voltage is. It's a weighted sum of PSP. So the memory potential relative to threshold is just this. So this is theory 101. This is what we do. It's not actually a bad approximation. However, it's actually a little... At the end of the talk, I'm going to go back to this, right? But for the first part of the talk, this is the work we've been done, I'm going to actually make life simpler and discretize time. Okay? So spike goes from, you know, spike or no spike to 0, 1. And this is, so PSP goes to a 0, 1 binary variable, and this time is discretized in time step about a millisecond. Okay? So this is a model I'll be using for most of the talk. Once you do that, then your weights become just in each bin. The memory potential in each bin looks like that. And so we want to learn this situation. We need a feedback signal, okay? So I'm going to start with a very, very unrealistic feedback signal. But later I'm going to talk about much more realistic ones, including unsupervised learning, where there's no feedback signal at all. For now, assume we have a feedback signal, which means on every time step, we're told whether we're too high or too low. Okay? Some places we get this in the cerebellum, probably not deep in cortex, but that's the idea. So if error goes up, that means memory potential was too low. If it goes down, it means it was too high. The feedback signal is going to play heavily in this. It's basically the difference between the optimal memory potential and the actual memory potential. Okay? And of course, this is noisy. In fact, noise is huge, right? You don't get very much information in a particular time step, so we're going to add noise here. And noise, it's actually, we use several kinds of noise. The easiest to think about is Gaussian, but we use a situation where F is actually binary. So 0, 1, you know, too high or not too high. So that's a set. So basically we've taken this, which is pretty reasonable model of a neuron, and turned it into theorist 3, right? We have a spherical neuron, we have a point neuron, it looks like this. Time is discretized into zeros and ones, and now we can actually do some analysis. Okay? And again, I'm going to go back at the end of the talk and talk about the continuous time case, which I think is much, much more interesting. And of course, on every time step, the neuron is told, too high or too low, plus noise. And in fact, this is actually a regression problem. A little bit of a twist, because in a regression problem, you sort of have access to all the data. Synapses, this is going to be an important point. Each particular synapse doesn't know what the other synapses are doing. It might know about nearby synapses, but there's no way it's going to know about spikes on the other side of the dendritic tree. Okay, so one of the considerations is we can only use local information to learn. Okay, this is a setup. So this has actually been known forever how you could solve this. The famous delta rule, right? I don't know how old the delta rule is, but it basically makes a lot of sense. Let's say the feedback signal is positive. That means the memory potential is too low. So you increase the weights by amount proportional to the feedback signal, and you only update weight for neurons that spiked. Okay? Neurons that didn't spike give you no information at all. So this works, but it's suboptimal. It's suboptimal for two reasons. And the first one is, I mentioned a little bit earlier, the more sure we are about a synapse, the lower the learning rate should be. Okay? And the delta rule is the same learning rate for every single synapse, right? No matter how sure we are about it. It's pretty crazy. The other thing is, the more noise you're from the feedback signal, the lower the learning rate should be. This feedback signal is pretty noisy. Okay? And if it's really noisy, you want to pay very little attention of it to it. And if it's not noisy at all, you want to pay a lot of attention to it. Okay? And we'll see, and I'm going to show you shortly why it's sort of obvious why it's noisy. It depends on how many presynaptic neurons are active. So I'm going to go through these one at a time. They're actually very important for the rest of the talk. It's important that we know about them. In some ways, obvious. It's the usual thing. They're obvious if you've thought about them for several weeks. But let's take this scenario. At time t, let's say only presynaptic neuron 3 was active. Okay? So we have a 1 there, the rest are zeros. Memory potential is just the weight 3. And one could add noise to this, it's not a big deal. We didn't bother with it. We actually have noise in our simulations. The membrane potential is basically, the feedback signal is the optimal signal minus weight 3. So we actually get a lot of information about the weight of from presynaptic neuron 3 to our neuron of interest. Okay? And time step t plus delta t, we get more information about weight 3, 2 delta t, k delta t. Okay, so lots of time steps, we know a lot about weight 3. All of a sudden, on time step k plus 1 delta t, neurons 3 and 7 are active. Okay? Memory potential is some of those, but the delta rule says update them both by the same amount. Okay? So it's crazy, right? We know a lot about weight 3, and we update them both by the same amount. It's sort of a waste of resources. Then that'd be so extreme, it could be that these neurons are firing at a high rate, those are firing at a low rate. So high rate means low uncertainty, the other way around. And now neurons 3 and 7 are active, and you want to update. The change in weight 3 should be smaller than the change in weight 7. And this ultimately is going to lead to prediction about what one should see in vivo. Okay. And the other one is the more noise in the feedback signal. It's only slightly more subtle. So we go back to our old situation where we have one neuron active, so weight 3 is on. The feedback signal tells us a lot about weight 3. But now suppose all 8 neurons were on. Okay? Now the memory potential is the sum of all these weights, and the feedback signal is the sum of all these weights. And the point is, we don't really know which one to adjust. Right? We get information about all 8 weights. We have no idea which one should go up and which one should go down. Okay, so the effective noise scales with the number of active synapses. And that we should also take into account. Okay? So what we want is a souped-up delta rule, right? Instead of a sort of a learning rate that's the same for all time and all neurons, we want it to look like that. Okay? And that's what we're going to do. We're going to derive the optimal learning rate. We're going to figure out how to have this eta change over time and exactly how it should change and depend on various parameters. Okay? So the summary, this is if you guys absorb this picture, I'll be super happy. It's a fairly simplistic picture. So only presynaptic neurons 3 and 7 are active. Let's say they have this particular weight. We'll say the feedback signal is positive. The weight should increase. They're a little bit too low. The delta rule says do that. Both increase by the same amount. But suppose we were pretty sure about weight 3 and not about weight 7, the optimal thing to do is do that. Okay? So that's the main idea. And if instead of just 3 and 7 active, all 8 were active, delta rule says exactly the same thing. And the optimal thing to do is go not as far. Okay? So qualitatively, that's where we're going. We just basically haven't even quantified. You can sort of almost guess, right? The amount you change should be proportional to the standard deviation of the variance or something. So, but we'll work it out, okay? So what we have to do is turn this into quantitative theory. So we're going to be Bayesian. So if you're sort of an experimentalist and you half read journals, you see Bayesian all the time. It's made to be this exalted, really cool thing. So the real advantage of Bayesian is you don't have to think, right? Once you're Bayesian, the steps are completely and totally straightforward. It's just an algorithm. You turn the Bayesian crank. So it's a really, really good deal. You have to do a little bit of math, but not much. So Bayesian, when you see Bayesian, you should read easy. Okay, or at least relatively easy. I hope I didn't insult any hardcore Bayesians. I mean, look, there's a lot of hard stuff when you're Bayesian, but the steps are pretty straightforward. Okay, we don't actually need much beyond Bayes' theorem and a little algebra. Okay, so here's a setup. We're going to set the optimal membrane potential equal the weighted sum of some optimal weights. So the idea is there are optimal weights out there, and the brain's trying to infer them. Never actually sees these or knows what they are. What it wants to do is get a distribution over them, and for technical reasons, the goal of synapses is to compute a distribution of the log weights. Okay, and that's just because of Dale's law. Weights don't change side. Okay, so and it's actually a lot consistent with a lot of data that sort of log normal. So it's a reasonable assumption. We can make other assumptions as long as this is some distribution in which the weights stay positive. Okay? Now what's past data? That's membrane potential, feedback signal, spikes, and weights. But this is data for all past time since the animal was born. Okay? So this could go back years, decades, not much more than decades, but centuries for some of us. And it looks kind of complicated, right? You have to incorporate all this past data. But in fact, there's an incredibly well-known approach to this. It's a hidden Markov model, for those of you who know, but the idea is really simple. We assume we know the distribution on some time step t. We get new data.
So you're assuming a stationary environment, so that
no.
You use all past history you have, that's not a good thing to do.
So we're assuming a non-stationary environment. So you actually forget. So you, in some sense, you use all past, but you're exponentially weighted. You quit forgetting, yeah. So you're exponentially weighted.
But some... Well, some things change fast in the environment, some things don't,
yeah.
So
right now, so this is, you mentioned this before, it's a really good idea. Right now we're assuming that it's a hidden Markov model, so in each time step, the weight diffuses a little bit, Gaussian diffusion in long weight space, okay? And that's our assumption, and that's, you know, so it's some weak diffusion, and so the system has to track those. But you can imagine much more complicated transition rules, and there's certainly situations where, yeah, the world's massively changing, let's be more plastic, okay? It'd be reasonably straightforward to incorporate into the analysis, and it'd be very fun to do. So this is the data, and basically, you know, so you know the time step here, you compute the next time step, right? And that's basically the probability of log distribution given our data. Okay, it's about as simple as it can get. We get new data, we update our distribution, and we use Bayes' theorem for that. So probability of log weight given data, probability of data given log weight, probability of log weight divided by probability of data. Okay, so something everybody knows, and we'll don't worry about that. We just care about the distribution. So this is basically our main equation, right? And it's so important, I'm going to make it hard to read by putting it in the yellow box and purple things around it, okay? It's super, super important. So I don't know. I love, when I go to talk, I love to see equations, but I really love to see equations I've seen before, okay? If you're not used to looking at these equations, there's subscripts and time dependence and blah, blah, blah. It's actually sort of simple, right? Let's log weight is just, we'll just call that L. So we know that we want to know the distribution on the next time step, right? That's a distribution given new data, and we get to get that from Bayes' theorem. That's all that's going on here, right? There's time dependence and I's and blah, 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 but this is really about as simple as it can get, okay? So it's kind of cool. We have one little equation that tells us everything. However, it's pretty unlikely Synapse can keep track of whole distributions. Okay, so we're going to use what's commonly done. We'll assume a parametric form, which is log normal. And other parametric forms are possible. As you'll see, it doesn't really matter. It changes things in a fairly minor way. But we want to use a parametric form that has a small number of variables. Right? So basically, once you assume things are log normal, you only have to keep track of the mean and variance. Okay? So these are the things we want to keep track of, right? And we just need update rules, that's all. And again, I want to emphasize, previous learning rules in neuroscience have only updated the mean, we're going to also update the variance. That's the contribution, right?
Is this assuming the independence over eyes?
Independence of what? So, yes and no. So for supervised learning, so in fact, the distribution of the X's is going to influence how well you learn. But in fact, you know, each synapse sort of sees spikes in memory potential and feedback signal, right? It doesn't know about the other synapses. So in this model, we treat things as not so much independent as unknown. Okay, and you'll see actually at some point where we make an independence assumption, and we can maybe think about modifying that. In the supervised learning case, the structure in the X's becomes very, very important. Okay, and that's, I'm not going to talk about that in detail because we understand it least well. But it's,
I guess I didn't understand. I thought in the case where you've got, say, all eight neurons responding, then vectors shorter,
there's a big question. So the question is, does a neuron know? Does the synapses know about this? And our current thinking is they get some information about the net conductance. It gives them a noisy information about how much about that. So we're actually running right now simulations in which we don't take that into account. Okay, and they take days, right? So I was hoping they'd be done today. Maybe they'll be done this afternoon. I'm not going to ask, but yeah. So that's it's completely unclear. So we actually, you know, we're guessing. We're basically hypothesizing a theory, some fairly strong assumptions, and then we can go test it experimentally. Okay. So the update rules are basically this form: delta mu and delta sigma squared. This is the mean on time next time step minus the mean on this time step variance of those things. Okay. And they have a super simple form. It's probably very, very well known. It took us about a year before we noticed it. It looks like this, right? I don't know. Super simple is in the eyes of the beholder. We're going to make this equation look simpler soon. But you know, for those of you, the statistic, that's a score function that's approximate to the minus Fisher information, which is kind of cool, but not super relevant. But what's important from a theory point of view is the update rules depend only on the first and second derivative of the momentary evidence. It's log likelihood, right? So if we can write down a log likelihood, all we have to do is take derivatives, right? It makes our life really, really easy. So we're happy to find this because we spend a lot of time doing complicated integrals. Okay. The caveat is this momentary evidence has to be weak. That's typically the case. But you can imagine situations where plasticity has to be cranked up and maybe you get departures from this. Okay. But most of the time, plasticity is relatively weak. Okay. So the picture is actually something we're very, very familiar with. So let's say this is distribution at previous time set, we'll call it the prior. We get some information via the likelihood, right? Data comes in and tells us something about this distribution, and we update the posterior, right? And if these were Gaussians, you know, many of you have seen these before. If you haven't, it doesn't matter. You get really nice, simple rules for updating the mean and the variance. But what's important is, if this variance is small compared to the variance of the likelihood, you're dominated, the mean doesn't change much. The amount of change is proportional to the variance, right? The amount of variance changes is proportional to the variance of the
sigma 1 squared, so forth.
So it seems like you're hypothesizing that each individual they're on is representing a parametric Bayesian distribution. But you started by saying there's an overabundance of neurons. It seems like an alternative hypothesis would be that there's a lot of neurons representing a non-parametric Bayesian distribution, like more akin to a particle filter than a Kalman filter. So why are you, is that testable and what's to lead us towards the version you say rather than the...
It's an interesting point. So we probably it's testable. My guess is it'd be fairly hard, right? It sort of depends on the distribution, the way the synapse uses. You can't, I mean, if you think of experiments you can do, you can't really peer inside the synapse. You kind of can, but it's an interesting question. So we don't actually know how the synapse keeps track of its variance, right? So we sort of know the changes that synapse goes, release probability and AMPA receptors. For mean, how it keeps track of the variance is unknown. And that's sort of, if we can convince ourselves there's something to this theory, then we can spend a lot of time looking hard for that.
So couldn't that variance be represented over a set of redundant neurons, each with a different...
Well, so remember, a synapse has to decide what to do when a spike comes, right? So it's gotta either pick a value or pick a distribution. So a synapse itself has to make a decision when a spike arrives, right? We'll get to this later, but it really needs to keep track of its own weight, right? The weight could be, in some sense, tied to other weights, so this can go up and this can go down, and you're fine, right? But there's issue of locality, right? You don't really, it's hard to, this synapse doesn't know about this one. You can imagine designing network learning rules so that happens. But the truth of the matter is...
Second messenger system or something.
Yeah, so I mean, but that's, yeah.
And
yeah, and so who spends most of the time looking at synapses? Glial cells, right? And glial cells are kind of big. So this is basically the mechanism it does this is unclear, but each synapse does have to keep track of something, right? And so you can have a particle filter within a synapse, but I'm not sure what it would mean to spread it out. Maybe we can talk about this later if you have ideas. We can talk about it. It's I'm not. I can sort of guess what you're saying, but I'm not quite sure. Okay. So this is basically a straightforward algebra, right? Sigma 1 squared is much smaller than sigma 2 squared. And this idea is basically, it's three lines, literally three lines of algebra, which means six lines of algebra, but it's really short to show this, right? And the nice thing about this, likely it doesn't have to be Gaussian. Likely it isn't even normalized, often isn't even normalizable, right? It just has to vary slowly in the vicinity of the previous posterior. And it kind of makes sense. All that matters really is the derivative here that tells you how much you move, and the degree of convexity tells you how much the variance changes. Okay, so it's kind of a nice result. Okay, and we're going to make it look better by getting rid of the logs and just replacing this in terms of effective variance. Okay, and it's got this nice feature, right? The more uncertain the synapse is, the bigger the variance, the more plastic it is, right? It falls out of it. It just basically falls out of this, right? It's the exact same origin of this thing. You know, move it by the difference in the mean, weighted by the ratio of these variances. Might have been a good idea to drive it. I hate it when people put stuff up and don't drive it, but you could sit, if you end this talk, sit down, pencil and piece of paper or a pen, and it will not take you long. So I'm going to give an example. So this now gets back to the question of time-varying effective noise, right? So I'll give an example when this is the feedback signal. I'll give it a time just to make it look smaller. Remember, the membrane potentials have also weighted some, okay? And so what I'm giving you an example of, I'm going to write down explicit expressions for this thing. Okay, I'm not going to quite drive them, but you'll sort of see. And what we want to do for synapse size is separate this term. So this may answer some of your questions, right? It looks like this. The reason we do that is because the synapse knows about these quantities. It knows about, doesn't know about the value of W up, but knows some distribution, and it sees a feedback signal. It doesn't know about that. Okay? So from the point of view of the synapse, that's just noise. Right? And the real question you have to, when you're Bayesian, you always have to decide who believes what. The question is, does the synapse know anything about this noise? That noise is basically, if you square these things and you make the x's independent, or make these weights independent, right? So the independent assumption comes in here. It just looks like that, and we can basically sort of sum over all the neurons. So that's the variance of the noise, and it's got this important feature that the more active neurons, the more variable, the more noisy it is, right? Something we saw earlier. It just falls out of the map, right? That's just sigma f squared. So now we assume the synapse knows this, and again, we want to know what happens when it doesn't. Simulations aren't done. But we turn the Bayesian.
Peter, this is only for a feed forward network then.
No, this is for a network.
But in a recurrent network, if your signal component is small, and then there are actually dependencies, right? In a recurrent network, the dependence is.
So you're talking about this independence assumption?
Exactly.
Yeah, so.
The noise independence assumption is assuming that the noise correlations, or the correlations between xi and xj, are smaller than the signal over there, right?
Yeah.
That may not be.
Yeah, so, but it doesn't really matter. So we could actually put that in. So that makes this bigger, right? And so it's a big question about how much the brain cares about that and tries to compute it, right? So you can put it in there anything you want, right? Surprisingly, noise correlations turn out to be small. And so usually, this is order n, and if you include a correlation to be order n squared, that turns out to be usually order n, or a number of active synapses. But it's a good point, right? So this is a very interesting question, how much a synapse knows about this thing, right? But turn the Bayesian crank actually means take derivatives, what's nice about this theory. And you get kind of a big, ugly-looking equation there, but mi is a mean value of the weight, not the mean value of the log weight. But you see all the relevant features, right? This is our time-dependent, we said we've derived under Gaussian noise and the assumption that neurons know about how many presynaptic neurons are firing. We've derived basically the optimal learning rate as a function of time and neuron. Okay, it's got nice features. Higher uncertainty, faster updating, it's higher this thing. And then fewer presynaptic cells active, faster updating. That's that. Okay. So it's got all the features we talked about earlier. It's now quantitative. Now it's quantitative, we can actually make predictions. Okay. So this is a learning, this is a forgetting I talked about earlier. There's actually a forgetting term here, but it turns out to be very small. This is the important one. Tau is on the order of at least days. Right. So it's a really big question how fast we forget. And given how fast we forget, how do we remember anything? But in most of our simulations we use days, there's some data on that. But we don't really know what that is. And it probably changes a lot from area to area. I'm guessing it's more complicated than the relatively simple model. But that allows things to drift over time, and it drifts in sort of a reasonable way. It's just kind of fluctuating along. It's basically an OU process in log weight space. We can say four feedback signals. So the simple one, when this is Gaussian noise, we call that continuous in the plots. So this is a much more realistic feedback signal. Okay, this is like the Purkinje cell. You get a 1 if it's above some threshold, 0 if it's below some threshold. That's Purkinje cell type feedback signal. That would be associated with a complex spike, and that would lead to LTD, strong LTD. Often get this backwards. No complex spike, weak LTD. Okay. And then we also looked at something like, we picked absolute value of F. This is a reinforcement learning type signal. Okay. So when you reinforce a learning situation, you're getting feedback. Basically what you get is a reward. How big is it? And the size of that reward influences how far off you think the memory potential is. And we use absolute value. We could have used any function. But it's got this, it actually adds extra noise, because when you get a feedback signal, you don't know whether you were too high or too low. Right? But by taking into account the past, you actually know something already about the synapse. You can work that out. Okay. So, and you can put any kind of noise in there. We also had no feedback signal in supervised learning. For this, you need structure and data. Right? And we assumed, I mean, think PCA. Right? We assumed ICA, but we're just making up structure. We actually want to look at more interesting inference problems where we have a reason to believe the structure is the way it is. Okay, but this is sort of a proof of principle. Okay, so things did pretty well. So the optimal weight is the blue one, which the neuron doesn't see. The red is the inferred weight, and usually does a good job. It has a hard time with unsupervised learning, but it follows it pretty well. These are the error bars, 2 standard deviations, and it's usually within them. So things are working well. It's not surprising, right? We basically sample from the model we generated the data from. So unless we made an algebra mistake, it's going to work. Okay. But this is an interesting plot. This is the ratio of the mean squared error for the classical learning rule to the mean squared error for the Bayesian rule as a function of this learning rate eta that I wrote down earlier. So this is a fixed learning rate. Okay. And for the supervised learning, it does about at least 5 times better. Right. That optimal learning rate, it's 5 times worse. Okay. You can imagine this would be a huge evolutionary advantage. Also, if you're a little bit off, especially if you're too big, right, you overfit and you're constantly bouncing around, you do horribly. And if you're too low, obviously you learn too slowly. Okay. And it's likely that the optimal learning rate varies over time and over situation. Right? There's sort of no way for the delta rule to work that out. Okay. And again, this was assuming that the neurons knew how many presynaptic spikes there were. This is going to drop a little bit when we drop that assumption, but I don't know how far. Okay, so that's a theory. And the question is, does it have anything at all to do with the brain? It makes 2 predictions. So the first one, well, we'll get to the prediction in a second. We know plasticity depends on uncertainty. We have a situation like this. It always shows up, right? Uncertainty dependence. We also know the higher the firing rate of the presynaptic cell, the lower the uncertainty, okay? And that's because it's only an update. The synapse only gets information when a presynaptic neuron fires under our model, okay? When the presynaptic neuron fires, the variance gets a little bit smaller, as it always does in Q integration, and between firings, it gets a little bit bigger, okay? So basically, the prediction is plasticity, the ability to induce LTP, is a decreasing function of presynaptic firing rate, okay? So you have a neuron up there, it's firing like mad. If you went in and tried to do some LTP protocol between these two neurons, it should be really hard to move the synaptic weight around. The neuron's firing at a very low rate, it should be easy to move it around. Okay? And these experiments are difficult but possible, right? And, I mean, pretty straightforward. Part of it's done. Observe activity in vivo, compute firing rates of neurons, sacrifice animals, perform LTP, LTD experiments on identified neurons, so you know the firing rate of the postsynaptic firing rate, and the prediction is, this is a plan from Michael Hoyer, but the prediction is, if the firing rate's hard, it should be hard in your LTP protocol to get this to induce plasticity. Okay? So plan this, I mean, this is simply a project already, a grant, but these are doable experiments. Okay? So the other one is remember, plasticity depends on the number of active presynaptic cells via that term. Okay? Experiments are also possible. This is a little weaker prediction because we don't really know if this is what's going on. But I think no matter what, the results will be interesting. So you do a LTP protocol where you stimulate both the 2 presynaptic neurons are stimulated and 1 post. Right? Some protocol where you stimulate these, depolarize that cell. And you can have LTP experiments with both active or just 1 active. And the prediction is more LTP when just 1 is active. Right? Because the neuron knows that there's just 1 active cell. So this is much more speculative, right? So weaker prediction. We don't really know if the synapse tries to compute this thing. And we also don't know how big it is compared to this noise. So this one, if it comes out negative, it's not the end of the world. If it comes out positive, it's kind of cool. And this would be, a cerebellum would be a very natural place to do this, because you get a slightly different form, but it's similar. So you can ask about the cerebellum. Does it actually know how many presynaptic spikes there are in parallel fibers? Okay. These are also planned. Okay, so that's it for Bayesian learning. So it depends. So let me make sure I understand your question. So is your question, is the problem is that the presynaptic firing rate is actually going to sometimes be high and sometimes be low?
Well,
or
it's one thing sort of the microcomputer situation where you're like a quiet slice and then stimuli, but these things are changing all the time.
So which things are changing?
Firing rates are fluctuating constantly. Stimuli in the natural world are changing, but the weights are changing much more slowly. Right?
So the fact that weights are changing slowly is fine. In fact, we expect them to change slowly. So these LTP protocols are a little odd because they give you big... Is it because the LTP protocols give you very large changes in weight? The maybe not the kind of thing you see in vivo?
Right.
Yeah, so that's a big problem. We would love to be able to get at the synaptic weight in vivo. That would nail it, right? That's currently not possible. So Adam Packer, I don't think Adam Packer's in my Microbial Lab, he has this pretty cool setup where they can stimulate and optogenetically and actually record, usually there's a big blanking period, they can record very fast. But the problem is the dyes are too slow, right? So you can imagine stimulating a cell in vivo and then looking at the response of the postsynaptic cell. But you really want to look at the response in the first couple of milliseconds. But you get the response for tens to hundreds of milliseconds. So with faster dyes, we'll be able to do that. And that is actually a big worry. It's something that's always bothered us. The LTP, LTD protocols people use are probably very, very artificial. Right? And we're just crossing our fingers and hoping they have something to do with what LTP and LTD is going on in the brain. And that we're not going to be able to test until we can really measure synaptic strengths in vivo. With a standard protocol, the weight's seeing. We really want to track the weight, right? That would be the dream experiment. And that's going to be doable in on the order of a decade. But yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, I have a question how your learning theory has to do with inference. So in many inference problems, you actually have to worry about multidimensional uncertainty.
About what?
Multidimensional uncertainty, multidimensional posterior covariance. Whereas the theory, while it's very neat, is inherently one-dimensional because the standards can only care about the presynaptic occurrence, the one-dimensional phenomenon. How do you take that and is that possible to learn
So to answer that question, we're going to have to, pick a particular inference problem and talk about learning within the context of that inference problem. And that'll be nice because we'll have natural unsupervised learning. We're actually working on that for olfaction, where we think we know the generative model and we think we know sort of how learning is done and where it's done. But to answer that question, you really need a complete model involving a whole network where you do inference and learning at the same time.
I mean, basically, the multidimensional common field, we don't know the evolution.
I think the issue is, what's the feedback signal, right? Or on supervised learning, what's the update rule you use? And the feedback signal, so basically what we showed is, for pretty much if there's a feedback signal, or if there's not and there's interesting structure that in a particular way, things work. And my guess is, it's hard to imagine if you have the right feedback signal, something not working, right? It's Bayesian, it's going to be better than the standard way. But I think the real important work in the future is going to be to figure out exactly the feedback signals that the synapse is getting and how that relates to the function of the circuit. And cerebellum is a good place to start, where we think it's a supervised feedback signal, we know what it is. But deep in cortex, it's going to be a super hard problem. So we start in the periphery.
Okay.
It's a very good question.
So back to the question about using particle filter sort of mindsets versus parametric models for representing distributions. And usually one thinks of these weights between a pair of neurons as not being a single synapse, but being a large number of synapses. And that's what allows you to get the big dynamic range in the weights, right? Because the idea is that a single synapse maybe has a few discrete levels and that's it, right? So maybe three levels or four levels per synapse. So you're assuming a large dynamic range in the weights, but at the same time, you're assuming that a large dynamic range is stored in locally not only the mean value, but also the uncertainty has this analog quantity, which has a large dynamic range. So again, you would think that if the mean level is basically a sum of a bunch of connections with a pair of neurons, you would want to be more distributed. You would want to go...
So let me try to answer your question. It turns out that... So distributed synapses looks like a problem, right? It turns out the update rule for the weights is correct. The weights distributed synapses don't know each other, and they'll update the weights correctly, then total variance will and the total variance will be correct, and that sort of makes sense because the variance is going to be adding.
Yeah, but your updates are small.
The updates are small.
The dynamic range is huge for each synapse. Each synapse can store a number with many, many different graded values. In fact, two numbers, two analog numbers, which is crazy, right? Each synapse, usually, we think of each synapse as maybe storing three strands. Right?
So it depends on, that's a little controversial, right? So nobody quite knows. The range of synaptic strengths is actually pretty big, right? Mm-hmm. So nobody really knows whether it's binary or not. Binary would have some very, we could actually do binary, right? So one thing about this formula is that we can easily change the distribution. It helps if it's parametric. It'd be nice to think about non-parametric approaches to storing this thing. Which we haven't done, but it would be kind of interesting. But certainly we can change to multiple binary synapses, and the formulas would be pretty easy. In fact, we're going to do that when we get home, for a reason you'll see at the end of the talk.
So I want to suggest a possible implication of this, partly just to see if I'm tracking. So in a lot of systems that learn the input layer is large and the activity is contrived to be sparse. And so is it true then that one implication of your model that one consequence of sparse coding is that learning will be faster?
Yes. Yeah, so if the neuron does really keep track of how many presynaptic neurons are active, yes, it would be faster. Yeah.
So
that's kind of interesting, actually.
It would be a new take on sparse coding, which is sparse code. One purpose of sparse coding would be to accelerate.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very good point, actually.
My second question, we talked about this yesterday. I'm throwing it out just for the sake of discussion with the group. But several years ago, Larry Abbott published a neuron paper where they were thinking about binary weights versus analog weights. And binary weights have this disadvantage that you're always one transition away from forgetting. And their way of making neurons more stubborn, transitions more stubborn, was to say that strong synapse can have layers of strong, and each layer down has a harder chance of transition.
Yeah.
And as we discussed yesterday, it sounds like at some fundamental level, your theory is like that theory.
Yeah, in a way. So, actually, given our discussion now, that's later on a slide. But what we have to do, so we're going to do this as soon as I get home. So instead of assuming a log normal distribution, assume a binary distribution. And basically have the stickiness of the synapse depend on past history. And just start with that and see if it's, you can ask for optimal stickiness and see if that's consistent with these kind of cascading models. But that'd be one way the synapse might do.
And what your model is trying to accomplish is that if a synapse has been told over and over to be strong, then
that's exactly right.
And I think that, just to play devil's advocate, the head-scratching part of your model is how does a neuron keep track of variance?
Yeah, and so this,
it was sort of easier to imagine how you
get
lots of training onto, don't just make LTP, but now kind of build it in structurally so it's harder to make go away. And it was easier to map it onto biology.
Yeah, I don't think anybody successfully shown that's what's happening, but it hasn't been disproved either, so it's something that It would be very nice.
No, there's no evidence. Yeah. It's just sort of,
but it also seems more. So for those of you who weren't in on my and Michael's conversation yesterday, so Larry and Stefan Fuzzi had this very beautiful model where it stands for binary. And you can, if you're binary, you know, normally you think, well, you switch this way, you switch that way. But as he said, if you know over and over you got feedback signals saying that you should be in the high level, the probability of switching actually got smaller. So in some sense, your variance drops. So you're effectively dropping the variance, right? You're being very sure about the real point is, when you're sure about your value, you don't change, okay? And that would be, it would no longer be log normal, it would be binary, but the formalism is totally fine, and we can work out the details. So, okay, so, in, oh yeah, sorry. Okay, so it's because we have this forget, so if we didn't have forgetting, right, so we actually have this sort of forgetting term in there. And the idea, and our generative model is that synaptic weights actually drift over time. The optimal...
Say
that again? Oh, it's definitely a bit simplistic. I'm a theorist. I'm a theorist. So it's definitely simplistic. So one of the things, I often have a couple slides on this, but if you're a synapse deep inside a network, your optimal value is probably going to change in random ways because the rest of the circuit is changing. There's two reasons it's changing, right? The statistics of the world changes as you grow up and things change, but also the surrounding circuit changes, right? So it's probably true that your optimal weight drifts in more or less random ways. And that's what we've assumed. You're looking... Reducing the variance, but we actually have one term which actually increases the variance. Which I...
Forgetting.
No. It's a standard hidden... It is basic. It's a standard hidden Markov model where... So basically, these hidden Markov models, between time steps, the actual weight drifts by a little bit. And then you want to infer its value, given the fact that you know how much it's drifting. So we can talk about it later. I mean, it's certainly simplistic. There's no question about that. Right? But this drift here is fairly reasonable. What's not reasonable is the Gaussian drift, I think. But it's not unreasonable that the optimal weights are going to drift over time. I mean, we're actually not 100% positive about that, but that's our assumption. Okay, so here's the bottom line. If synapses keep track of their mean and variance, they can learn better, not a big surprise. But we're left with a question, okay? When a spike comes, what weight should the synapse use? Okay, we haven't talked about that at all. We just said it stored its mean and variance, and we haven't said anything about the actual weight. So, synapse computed distribution of weights, it looks something like this. Here are two neurons, here's our weight. Presynaptic neuron spikes, what weight does it use? Okay? So there's something very obvious it could use, which is the optimal weight, right? It could be the mean, the mode, something like that, but basically pick that weight. And there are situations where that's what you want to do, okay? But if you're a good Bayesian, you might want to sample, okay? So, you know, so in different trials, you basically sample from this distribution. And even if you're not a good Bayesian, there are sampling makes sense from sort of a biophysical point of view. And the reason is, you know, if a synapse is very, very unsure about the value of its weight, why spend a lot of effort and volume, probably, to really make sure that its weight is the same in every trial? If you sort of have one example of a very, very reliable synapse, KX of Hill, that's huge, right? On the other hand, if you're pretty sure, you might want to put resources into making sure the weight's about the same every time. Okay. So this is what we call synaptic sampling hypothesis. It's pretty speculative. And the idea is synapses sample from the distribution over weights on every time a spike arrives. Okay, and they're actually sampling. I mean, the sampling is sort of a big debate about whether the brain does sampling, and there are reasons to do it. And we don't know if the brain does it. So this is an additional hypothesis. Okay, if it's true, it's super cool because it gives us a way of accessing the variance. So remember, we can measure the mean weight, right? That's really easy. Period recorder, you presynaptic spike, you know, what's the weight, right? We have no idea how the synapse stores its uncertainty, right? It's not necessarily directly accessible. If we make this hypothesis, it is accessible, right? We can just basically look at the variability, trial variability, and that tells us the neuron's uncertainty, okay? So again, it gets an ugly yellow box. And it gives us a couple more predictions. It makes one of our predictions much easier to test. Okay? So we've seen this slide before. Plasticity depends on uncertainty. Right, sigma I squared, the higher the finite of the cell, the smaller the variance is. So prediction we saw earlier is the ability to produce LTP is scales inversely with the presynaptic fiber. Okay? And the experiments were difficult but possible. However, if we can actually directly measure this thing, this is the prediction, right? Go in and measure sigma squared in paired recordings, and then try to reduce LTP. Okay? You can go in and measure presynaptic firing rate and then measure the variance. So you don't need to do LTP experiments. And the idea is that the presynaptic firing rate is pretty high over some long periods. The variance you measure in paired recordings should be smaller. Okay? So this experiment, which is difficult but possible, turned into an experiment that's already been done. Right? This is so Tom Mershak Flogel has done this. We're waiting on data from him, right? He basically did this is Nature paper with Ko a couple of years ago. He observed, using calcium imaging, the firing rate of a population of neurons, sacrificed the animal, looked at identified neurons, and did recordings to get the mean and the variance. Okay? So the data exists, right? So as soon as he sends it to us, he promised a week ago, but we haven't got it, we'll actually be able to answer, sort of answer this question. It's complicated because getting firing rate from calcium imaging is tough, but we can at least get a sense of whether this makes no sense at all. Okay? It also makes a new prediction, right? Plasticity depends on uncertainty. We've seen this before. The ability to produce LTP is an increasing function of variance. Okay? Again, you go and you measure variance, right? Then you do an LTP protocol and ask how plastic is the neuron. And this has been done. We're pretty happy about this. We made this prediction, and we talked to them about Jester Sjostrom, and he had this data, hadn't been published in this form yet. He gave it the data, we analyzed it. And this is the variance over mean. It turns out to be the relevant variable. This is a percentage change in an LTP protocol, and it's increasing, right? The observed slope is 0.66, which is different from zero. The predicted slope is 1, so it looks like that. It's not statistically significantly different from the actual slope. So this is hardly something you'd stake your career on, right? But it's nice and it's suggestive. So these experiments one can do. It's relatively straightforward. So finally, this gives us a new, maybe strong, certainly different way of thinking about plasticity. So let's go back to our favorite equation, right? Remember, delta mu is the difference between the next time step, previous time step, so we're going to divide these by delta t. Take a limit delta t to go together, we've got a differential equation. Okay? And now we don't have to worry about discretizing time. We have to be a little bit careful here, right? This is data between t and t plus delta t. We no longer have the Markov property, so we have to consider all past data. But because this is only information limited time step, this the limit dt goes to zero, this should converge to something that's not infinity or zero, and the same with that. And d of t is no longer this feedback signal we made up. It's what the neuron sees. Right? It's calcium signal, dopamine, spikes, failures, anything you want to see. It can be different for pre- and postsynaptic parts of the synapse, but it's what's actually there. Okay? And all we need to do is compute this quantity. So this is probably going to base on stochastic differential equations. And so now we have a sort of a set of differential equations describing how the synapse evolves. And based on what we think about the biophysics of the neuron. Okay, I'm kind of excited about this, actually. And the idea is to link local biophysical synaptic signals to optimal updates. Okay? So that's when there's a feedback signal, that's reasonably straightforward. Okay, so cerebellum is the first place to start. For unsupervised learning, it's a lot harder. Right? We're starting to look at, like I said, I mentioned this earlier, in the factory system, we think we have a handle on how inference might be done. So it's work in progress, but we expect it to yield insight into why we have the learning rules we do. Okay, this is sort of what we expect. It's always nice to expect things right before you do the analysis. But we've seen a slide before, right? This is the likelihood. This is the kind of situation when you would get when the presynaptic spike precedes the postsynaptic spike, right? You switch them around, the likelihood would switch to the other side. That's SDDP, right? So it would be really nice to start with something fundamental about what we think the neuron's getting, the kind of information the neuron's getting, and then turn the Bayesian crank and write down rules for which this popped out. And so we know under what circumstances why STDP is a good idea. So that's pretty much it. Here's a summary. The brain can't know its optimal weights. It can compute probability distribution over those weights. Okay. This allows for faster learning. So this part is, I think, pretty solid, right? And you know, 150 million years of evolution, it's something the brain might do. Okay. The more speculative idea is that given that distribution, it samples. It chooses different weights at each time step, and the variance of that when it samples is actually proportional variance of its actual own estimate of its uncertainty. Okay. So far, it's consistent with experiments. And notice that with this hypothesis, weights are automatically noisy. And that's a feature, not a bug. So if this is correct, it explains what, in my mind, is one of the biggest mysteries in neuroscience, which is why I have failures. Right? It's insane. You spend all that energy making a spike, and then half the time, nothing happens. It's crazy, right? What was the brain thinking? But in this case, it's the outcome of sampling. Okay? And finally, this is more solid too. We're back to black. This framework allows us to link low-level biophysics to optimal learning. Okay, I want to thank. Oh, so this is. Keep this in mind, right? This is the picture. Delta rule, optimal rule. And you have that in your brain, and you will have gotten most of the talk. I guess it could have been shorter. And synapses, of course, need to keep track of both the media and the variance in order to update optimally. Okay. So future work, the theory is falsifiable, right? That's kind of nice. I think I may have this reference wrong, but. It requires them to keep track of both the mean and the variance. And yesterday, when I made the slide, I had no idea. But after talking to Michael Mock, this multi-state synapses, which we talked about earlier, which could be the wrong reference, is one way to do it. Okay, and that's something certainly worth looking into. Right? And from a theoretical standpoint, this is nice. That the formalism is really general, easy to use. Right? Basically, you need to. Write down the expression for the likelihood and take a derivative, right? Or two derivatives. I mean, it's pretty much a piece of cake. So one thing. So Lawrence Aitchison is grad student, does a lot of this work. Super, super, super smart. Irritatingly smart. So he's done a lot of this work, and then these ideas has come out with discussions with Alex Puget, my longtime collaborator over the last couple decades. Okay, thank you very much. So the question is, what if you have a punctate change? And so the optimal weight changes very, very suddenly. So it gets harder, right? It's something we would, so this is, Bill Geister actually mentioned this also, so UT Austin thinks of these things. It would be nice to actually include that. And basically have situations where the world's very plastic, you think things are changing rapidly. It certainly would be doable. It's, you know, math is harder, but there's no fundamental. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 So, I mean, you know, so that's some sense. If we knew how the brain worked, it'd be a lot easier. And certainly it's one-shot learning, right? And so we're gonna yeah, so we look at that. And the factor says we're going to look at that because we think we have a lot of experiments and we have a lot of handle on what's going on. But, I mean, yeah, it's an important thing to take into account eventually. Yeah, so that's actually a good point.
Have you tried putting in some numbers from which about the
religion? No, we haven't. Partly because it's actually crossed my mind, right? You get lots of synapses and lots. But in a particular time bin of about 10 milliseconds, right? You actually don't have that many presynaptic neurons firing. So, yeah, it's I should work it out. It wouldn't be that hard. But I think I think the effect doesn't totally wash out, but it'd be interesting to work out how big it is. Part, of course, is you really need a sort of a model where inference involves sampling. And then you can do something quantitative. Until we have one of those, it's probably not necessarily worth doing.
So
think about, basically the reinforcement learning feedback signal is sort of the level of reward you get, right? Yeah, the TD learning, but the actual signal is a reward, and TD learning does various things with that, right? But if the reward is big, if the reward is small, right, you don't know whether your memory potential was too high or too low. You just know it was off somehow. You did something wrong, very, very, very loosely. So it'd be with a whiteboard, it'd be a lot easier. But I mean, that's the idea. If the reward is really low, all you know is you're off. You don't know if you're too high or too low, right? If the reward is really high, you know you're about right. But the negative reward and positive reward is fine. The question is, if you're a neuron, if you're a synapse deep in the brain, you get a negative reward, do you make your memory potential bigger or smaller? You don't know, right?
No, what your current prediction is. I mean,
the prediction, remember, we should probably talk about this later, but I'll say one more thing. The prediction is about something in the outside world. There's no prediction about...
Wave
direction.
Right,
should be.
It's unsigned error term. Think of it as unsigned error.
Let's talk about it later.
I think it's a super naive question. It seems like you're trying to measure the variance in your models, if I understood correctly, over time. But in your cartoon, when you had one presynaptic and one postsynaptic cell, I'm wondering if this model is, I wanted it to measure it instantaneously. You have this cartoon, pre and post, where the presynaptic cell is making multiple connections.
Yeah.
Isn't that a way to measure at one fire point the variance by comparing all the synapses?
So if you could do that, that would give you a lot of information, right?
But certainly a cell can do that, right? It can
especially, depends on how far apart they are.
Yes, not, there would be reasons, but...
So if you have ideas, off the top of my head, I wouldn't know exactly how to implement that. If the ideas would be very cool, because you know, the fact that you have different, if they're far apart, it's pretty much no way. If they're nearby, maybe you could do something. But
represent the variance.
Yeah, yeah.
At one moment.
Yeah, but I mean the thing is, it's the variance affects plasticity, right? So it sort of has to be stored in some physical internal quantity inside the synapse, right? It's got to know what its variance is, so when it updates the weights, it changes by a lot or a little. So reading it out and storing it are different things, right? And whether or not it reads out the way we think it would do is an extra hypothesis. But under this model, it has to be stored somewhere in that synapse.
Couldn't that sort of just be by the old school type of Hebbian strengthening?
So Hebbian strengthening doesn't keep track of variance; it just changes the weight.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering whether they're the same thing.
No.
Compared multiple synapses at one point in time, but they're seeing the variance, and then that provides a way to create the weight.
That, I guess, have a less positive note to think about that. So my guess is, I don't think so, but I'm not 100% positive.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.